Now we'll be approximately following the material in the booklet. So if you'd like to turn up page 36 in your booklet, the study for today, or the matter for our attention today, is the Father's wisdom for our children. Now, some may not have been able to catch up with the earlier material, and that's not essential for today. But from another point of view, if you'd like to catch up on that, the tapes are available either as audio tapes or as videos. So speak to Peter afterwards, or Helen, if you'd like to do that. But let's just recall very briefly that we've been talking about God making a covenant with all the with all of his people, and that from the beginning that covenant has been made with those who heed the word, but also with their children. And so we understand that the matter of covenant is a familial thing, that it is, it relates to families, because God is very concerned, more concerned than we are, if we can put it that way. God is very concerned for the continuance of his covenant, and that means the next generation. So our grounds for confidence is not because of our incredible parenting and how wonderful we are and how wonderful our children are, but our grounds of confidence are that God himself has made a covenant with humanity, and that that covenant will be made with our children as much as with us. And so it's because of God's purpose rather than our wonderful faithfulness that we are so sure of what we're about. So there's the covenant that God has made. I'll have to leave it at that, and you can pursue that more in the booklet and in the cassettes if you wish to. So that's the covenant in which we raise our children. As part of that, we understood that it was our task to represent to our children the Father's authority. That is, God is in charge, not just that he will be if we represent it to our children, but he is anyway. And the whole world is being governed under the Father's authority. If our children don't know that, they'll always be banging their heads against the wall. We might as well teach them young as old. So do you see the point? The Father's in charge. We might as well understand there is authority in our world. We can't sin with impunity. We get away with nothing. So the earlier the children know that, the sooner they'll flow with how it is. So we represent to our children the Father's authority, and we represent that to them as those who themselves are under it, of course, under the Father's authority. We also represent to the children, which was study three, the Father's forgiveness. In other words, if we could find today the centre from which all the world was being governed, and we stood before the great throne of none less than God himself, we would find that the throne of God is a throne of grace. That's where we go to pray, isn't it? In other words, we will never understand this world if we understand that it's being run on the basis of justice. The world is not being controlled by mere justice. And thank heavens it isn't. Would you like justice? Would you like to be repaid for every sin you've ever done? And are you? Well, for the moment, you've got an incredible reprieve. We've got an incredible reprieve, haven't we? God is being gracious to us. He's not giving us what we deserve. At the head of all authority and rule is Jesus Christ, who bore our sins in his own body. The world is being governed according to the principles of grace. Justice is still in full operation, but mercy triumphs over judgment, as we've seen. Now, we can't go back over that. Now, what an incredible thing, then, to represent that to our children. Not the relaxing of standards, but in fact, the coming to the presentation of those expectations of God's law by the God whose law they are, the God who is gracious. That is, we shall always be ready to forgive our children. We'll always be ready to assume that, not to assume, but to treat our children as though they've never done a thing wrong in their lives. Wouldn't it be beautiful this morning to go home and to be able to treat your child like the sweet young innocent thing that you thought it was when you first brought it home? Wouldn't it be lovely to be able to put behind you all that need to have reprisals and hidden agendas and paybacks against your children for the sleepless nights they've given you, and just go home having forgiven them totally for everything and just have all that sweet relationship that you've had and the best day you ever had? Great thing, forgiveness, isn't it? And God's cross, that is Christ's cross, assures us that that's the way that God's treating our children, and that's what we must represent to them to faithfully represent God. It's a great calling, isn't it? To represent to our children the forgiveness of God. So that was the matter of forgiveness. And just as one illustration of that came up in question time last week, and it was suggested that we might put it on cassette this week by beginning this way, we recalled last week how God came to David and made a covenant with David that he would bless his household and would never take away the kingship from David. And that was a great promise to David. But in the process, God said to, it's 1 Samuel 7:14, in the process God said to him, I will be the father of your son, that is, David's son was Solomon, and God was telling David that his son Solomon would be king after him. You see, the promise is to you and to your children. Now, here's a covenant. It's a different covenant than the covenant we've made with us, but it is a covenant made with David concerning his son. You see how covenants can relate to the next generation? And, of course, we know that our covenant is too. But here a covenant is made with David concerning his son, and it says to David, he shall build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever, and I will be his father, and he shall be my son, and when he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but I will not take my steadfast love for him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. So chastening can happen without taking away steadfast love. Can you follow that? In other words, there's a steadfast, stable covenant where we are bound and sworn to love our children as God loves us, his children, and even though chastenings are necessary, then it's not the removal of love, rather it's the actual love of itself doing the chastening. Marvellous thing. And how we'd ever have got that balance without God himself being that way, I don't know. In fact, I know we'd never arrive at it. We always wobble as human beings. But God himself, being who he is, can in fact vow that certain things will happen in regard to our families, and he can also make a covenant with us concerning our families, and he can say, I will never take my steadfast love. You might go through all hell, but I'll never take my steadfast love away from you. And we saw also that David himself learned the truth of that, because when he sinned against Bathsheba and against her husband Uriah by having him murdered outside on a suicide mission in battle, he pleaded with God for forgiveness, and he pleaded with God not to take his Holy Spirit from him as he took it from Saul. And so David came to God, and God said, your sin is forgiven, your iniquity is pardoned. But the child died. He was a man of blood all his life, and he had rebellion in his own household as punishments. And they were lifelong punishments. You see that? And David had to live through Absalom's rebellion, his own favoured son, who rebelled against him with all the awfulness of that. He had the awfulness of having to walk out of Jerusalem and leave his throne behind, because he would rather do that than fight against Absalom, his beloved son, who'd rebelled against him. Now he goes through all the awfulness of seeing the son whom he loved and had rebelled against him murdered. Can you imagine, if you think you've got family troubles, well, just think of David for a little while. The traumas through which he went were incredible, but they were not just troubles that were accidents. God promised that that would happen because he sinned in the face of all Israel. God made him go through quite some difficulties in his life because he'd been an evil man. But he went through those difficulties as a forgiven person. Can you see that? And we might think that everything that goes wrong with us is somehow or another a sign that God's getting us. Well, no, chastisements can be a necessary discipline upon our life without them being reprisals. Can you see that? Because he went through that as a forgiven man. And when somebody says, why don't you kill that guy that's just been shouting out to you, I think it was Shimei, yielded some abuse as he was going out of Jerusalem. And David simply said very meekly, oh no, I don't do that. He said, God might have sent him to abuse me. You see, he was a forgiven man. He was a man whose spirit had become tranquil under forgiveness, even in the midst of God's chastisements. Now, can you see what covenant can do for you that nothing else can do? We have all kinds of difficulties in our life, some of which are the fruits of our own doings. And we have to live with the social consequences of our actions, isn't that right? But we don't have to live with the social consequences of those actions as people who constantly feel, God's punishing me for it. No, they are chastisements. They are helpful disciplines around us to stop us from becoming rank in wickedness. We're children too, and God knows what's good for us. but we go through them as his beloved children who every day are experiencing his forgiveness. Now, do you see what I mean about we could never get that together? But God, the God of all the earth, who never does wrong, administers his law to us from grace. And that's the task of our children, for us with our children, to represent to him, to them God's authority, sure enough, but never as legalism, and to represent to them God's forgiveness, but never as softness, and only God's covenant is going to tutor us in how to live in such a manner. So now we come to the wisdom, in one sense, to live in the light of this great covenant and to represent God the Father's wisdom to our own children. Now, let's for a start, let me read to you Ephesians and chapter 1, not the whole of it, just a verse or two, but in Ephesians chapter 1 it's talking about the great Father and how he's related to us, and that's our cue all the way. Ephesians chapter 1 says, he destined us, verse 5, he destined us in love to be his sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace, which he freely bestowed on us in the beloved, that is Christ. And in him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of his grace which he lavished upon us. For he has made known to us in all wisdom and insight the mystery of his will, according to his purpose which he set forth in Christ. Now what we're talking about now is not the fact that God has a will. Of course he has. That's his authority, his will, his purpose, and he's going to accomplish that. But he makes it, and the fact that it's a plan of grace and mercy, which we've talked about. But now he says he makes it known to us in all wisdom and prudence. In other words, God doesn't just come to us in willy-nilly fashion, but in fact he comes to us in great wisdom. So let me just give an example of that. If we're training our children, there's two ways to go, we might say. One of them is the legalistic way, in which we say, this is what's right. If you do it, you're rewarded. If you don't, you get a smack on the back side, if you know what I mean. One sense, just a plain application of law. Now, we all know that a certain amount of that is necessary, so long as it's in the context of grace. But we also know that it doesn't cure the wound in our children. That is, not of itself. So legalism and just application of law alone isn't going to be right. On the other hand, the other way to go is to say, well, I want my children to love me because love is really what counts. And if I want them to go on loving me, I'm going to have to go easy on them. Otherwise, they'll turn aside from me. And that's the way that's been chosen by and large in our society, the latitudinal or permissive way. Now, can you see that God has not made his will known to us either by just legalism on the one hand or by permissiveness on the other hand? See, some people find out what their parents will, who their parents are by how much they'll get away with. And a lot of people think they're finding out about God by how much God lets them get away with. Can you see the connection there? I did this and God didn't punish me. Do you see that's assuming what God lets you get away with is okay? Now, if we let our children get away with things, can you see how we're just letting them find us out by being permissive with them? And they're going to find out that we're as weak as water, aren't they? And so forth. So it's no good for us just coming to our children in any old fashion. There's going to have to be the growth of wisdom, the gift of wisdom and the growth of wisdom, so that we can actually come to our children knowing that there is law, knowing that there is grace, but tutoring them up in it so that they understand both dimensions. And that's going to take all that we've got to give, and it's going to take a lifetime to learn it. I suppose some of us, as we're going through these things, like myself and Chris with me, are saying to ourselves, well, it'd be great if we knew all these things when we started. Well, that's the way of it. Somehow or another, we're going to spend our whole life learning about what it means to be a parent. And it's interesting to me to see the number of grandparents, and even quite older grandparents, who are very interested in how to bring up kids. It all touches us to the quick, doesn't it? We're always interested in what really matters as far as our children are concerned, or what should have mattered when we were, so that we always keep on thinking about it. That's a good thing, because it's going to take a lifetime to get all the wisdom that we need. And any little bit of wisdom that we can get, well, we can pass on to others. So let's not just despise the slow learning of wisdom. And I think, like we said quite early in the course, the only course God runs for parents is a crash course. In other words, you learn best, you know what I mean? Out of, in one sense, that doesn't make a course like this redundant. Of course it's helpful. It's all the promise of God, isn't it? But from another point of view, we learn so many things through the mistakes we've made, so that we wouldn't want to despise them. So let's then think about growing in wisdom. Let's just recall, too, as we begin, that what we need wisdom for is not just to raise smart kids who know how to use the world. In one sense, we teach our children a lot, don't we, about how to manage money, how to deal with toughies in the schoolyard. In other words, they have to grow up to learn to deal with a rough, tough world and all that kind of thing. So we teach them a lot that's useful, but let's be clear that what we're really concerned about is teaching our children to be God's children rather than this world's children, because it would be quite disastrous if all we actually taught our children was to be this world's children. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to think that because you were training your children up to be God's children, that they'd be pretty useless as far as this world is concerned. I'm persuaded that godly kids will do best in this world. Do you know what I mean? They might be laughed at by the world, but I know, and I'm sure you know too, that godly kids are going to do best. If you train your children to be God's children, they will know how to live in this world, because guess whose world this world is? It is God's world, you see, and those who think that they just train up their children to live in this world are going to rue the day that they didn't realise that there was more to it, because God's in charge of this world, not the capitalists. God's in charge of this world, not the socialists. Do you follow? And we might as well tell them first as last. In the short term, they may seem not to be prospering as much as those that have been taught to be pushy. But from another point of view, in the long term, they will thank God that we have taught them to live for Him in this world. So there we are. Now, who knows best? And this is dealing with the whole question of how convinced we are that we've got the right way. It must be clear that the things we teach our children have first been learned by us. The children are incredibly good discerners of what's really turning us on. And if, in fact, what is turning us on is just a general sense of well-being in the everyday world, which is one of Australia's idols, a general sense of well-being in the everyday world, and then take them to church on Sunday and teach them how to sit still during the church service and put money in the plate, then they will learn that what really matters is getting on in this world and being nice on Sundays and doing the right thing. Do you follow that? They'll actually understand. They'll pick up those dynamics. Whatever's turning you on, the children will sense that. They can sense their parents' moods just like that, can't they, from infancy. So we have to make it clear. I knew that when our children were coming up into what we might call the high risk area, you know, from about 10 to 18, I'm not sure that any area is the high risk area, but it's when we sort of begin to experience some of the risks of bringing up children, that in fact our children would not espouse something that was not enjoyable to Chris and the self. Can you see that? In other words, if I wasn't enjoying being a Christian, and if I wasn't enjoying the Christian vocation which I had, now, I couldn't expect my children to enjoy it, because they would pick up that I hated it or that I was just putting up with it. I'm either into it boots and all or not. And we just had to have confidence then that our children would see what we were really enjoying and into with all our heart and follow it, even those times when we don't know what's really happening inside them. I've likened training children to a bird feeding its young. You've probably all watched the bird bringing back the worm or the bits and pieces of stuff that they get all chomped up, pre-digested, and then go plop, plop on the little bird's beaks are wide open like they're about three quarters of their body size, and down it goes, you know. And the bird unceremoniously stuffs this stuff down to the children's mouths. Now, I don't recommend that we emulate the nature and the manner of the bird, but I think we've got to be as convinced as that mother bird or father bird that we've got the right stuff to feed our kids. Who knows best? Are you sure that you know best what's best for your kids? Well, you'd better be sure, because they're going to test that out to the last little inch of the way. They're going to declare uphill and down dale that you're the biggest fool and the most idiosyncratic parent that ever was. And you've got to be sure in your own mind you've got it right. What will make you sure that you've got it right, that it's working for you? Can you see that? You do know best. And if you'll know that you know best if you know that it's working out, and you're being realistic. So we're not suggesting that we just adopt that method of education which says, ram it in, cram it in, children's heads are hollow, ram it in, cram it in, still there's more to follow. We're not recommending the method of education, but we are recommending the assurance that we've got what really counts. And that mightn't sit easily with modern educational theory, which says that each child's got somehow or another heaven sort of locked up inside them, and we've got to give them enough rope to actually find it all out or hang themselves. That mightn't sit easy with that modern educational theory. Well, I'm afraid I can't worry about that. The Bible's saying, train up a child in the way he should go. And as you know it, so teach it to them. And you'll only know it's right if you're sure it's right for you. Now, our confidence in this, of course, is tempered by the memory that we ourselves have been foolish. So we're not just coming at it as I told you so and I've got it right. We've so frequently got it wrong that we've got an ample store and an ample reason to be sympathetic with our children. But do you see that our sympathy from that point of view doesn't need to temper our sureness? Well, it tempers it, but it doesn't doesn't temper our sureness. It tempers our approach to the children. Well, God can bring us to wisdom. That's the thing. God brought his own son to wisdom, didn't he? Jesus Christ grew in stature and in wisdom. So let's have confidence today, not in ourselves, but let us have confidence in God that he is actually training us in wisdom. And the same way that we can train our children in wisdom so that they can stand in the things surely that we stand in. Now there's two ways in which you can come at the matter of wisdom. The first one is gift, and the second one is that which comes by process, if you like. I'm not sure if that's the best word, but let's call it process. But let's look first of all at gift. How does wisdom come to us? Well, wisdom comes to us because we were caught red-handed in our sins, stupid, foolish, helpless, unable to help ourselves, and God said, what say I forgive you? And wisdom comes to us by just walking right out into the open and saying, I'm a mug, I've been stupid, I've been a fool. One of the most hard things about sin to face is that it's stupid. Some people are quite proud to have done something wrong, but nobody likes to be called stupid. Do you know what I mean about that? But the thing about sin is that it's stupid. It is totally irrational. There's no good grounds for it at all. Now, I haven't got time to go on that because there isn't a study on that. But the wisest thing to do is to say, I'm a fool. And receive the wisdom that comes to us in the shape of a cross from God forgiving us. Do you see how wisdom God has made Christ in the face of human beings that just like so much to be thought well of and as wise and together kind of people? God has come and said, all your wisdom is foolishness. So if in any way I think today I've got a kind of person who just needs a sort of a little bit of extra course to be a great parent, then I'm not talking to you. Do you know what I mean? Let's have the agenda quite clear. I'm not talking to you. You'd never learn anything from me. You'd never learn anything from God, because God has come and he's called our wisdom foolishness. He said, all you think was good, I've called stupid. But he said, what I have given to you is Jesus Christ, and what I've given to you is the forgiveness of sins, and what I've given to you is a brand new start based on totally different criteria from what you thought before. Are you ready for that? And the wisest thing to do is to just walk right out into the open, confess what fools we've been, and say, God, I like your way. Do you follow how wisdom comes to us as a gift? And it's not just that it came to us as a gift when we were a 16-year-old teenager and became a Christian or something like that. As it begins, so it continues. And today, of myself, I'm as foolish as ever. Do you follow that? Now, from another point of view, there's a lot of wisdom, hopefully, that God has given us over the years. But let's be clear that the kind of wisdom that God has given to us is the kind of wisdom where we know that it hasn't come from us, but it's come from a gracious God who caught us red-handed and foolish with our pants down, as we say, and said, what say I just forgive you? Now, while we're in that position, we're receiving God's wisdom as a gift. And that's the perspective that we have as we come to wisdom. And now there's other things that you can read in the book as well, but let's go on to the next one. The other strand of wisdom, bottom paragraph in that page 38, the other strand of wisdom is that which comes by patient living before the Father in all the ups and downs of our life. There are many times when God gives instant wisdom for particular situations, but there's a wisdom which comes by the constant exercise of our heart and mind and conscience in the context of our responsibilities and in the context of our failures. You might remember Hebrews 5, which says that there's many of you said who ought by now to be teachers, but in fact you're still having someone to need to teach you. I don't mean to say that you shouldn't have come this morning, but what he's saying to those particular people in that situation was, you ought to be more able than you are at the moment to teach others. And the reason why you haven't is because you haven't had your faculties exercised by reason of use to discern what is good and what is evil. Do you see how we could go through life without ever learning to exercise discernment and to look at something on telly and say, that stinks, and turn it off? Or say to your children, the reason I don't like that is 1, 2, 3, 4. Give them 48 reasons if you like, but don't just say it's bad, naughty, can't watch it. Give them reasons. Show them that you've thought about it. Do you follow that? But certainly, the Lord has a criticism of. He wants to deal with people who are still in their adult years lacking in discernment. You ought, he says, to have grown in discipline. In discernment, to be able to pick up what's crook and what's good. So there we are. So there's no shortcut from one point of view to wisdom. By nature of the case, sinners are foolish. And we go on finding ways in which we've been foolish in the last fortnight. And so again, you see, we never sort of somehow or another have a store of wisdom which we can now say, look what a wise person I've become. Somehow our wisdom is always contingent, that it is always dependent on the fact that God is a forgiving God. And it's always dependent on the fact that we know that we need it. But given that we haven't become, otherwise all you've got is a smart aleck. Do you know what I mean? And children can't stand smart alecks. But they can stand a wise person. A wise person is a person who constantly knows they're foolish and constantly knows the forgiveness of God in that. And in that context, yes, they are learning to discern what is good and what is evil. And they build up a store of wisdom. And they're not just people who say, well, grandma said it's wrong, mother said it's wrong, so I say it's wrong too. But they've thought through issues, proving all things and holding fast to what's good. So children love you to reason with them as they grow up a bit, don't they? I'll just say, that's wrong. Why is that? Because I said so. No good. Even God gave us a reason why we should keep the fourth commandment, didn't he? I mean, if anyone didn't need to give reasons, it was God. But he gave us a reason for the fourth commandment, that you may live long. It's the first commandment with a promise. He explained to us that it would be good if we did that. And in many other ways, he explained himself. But so as we go along, we're sure that we're right, but we're also prepared to explain why can we explain it? Because we've thought through it, and we've got our reasons as to why that's no good and why this is great. Paul, first of all, said that the only wisdom he knew was Christ. He said, I've not got any time for this world's wisdom. He said, the only wisdom I've got is Jesus Christ. But as a person who only had the wisdom of Jesus Christ, he was prepared to give his opinion on a number of matters, quite significant matters, even the length of women's hair. Now, I tell you what, if a guy is prepared to talk about that, boy, he's game, isn't he? Well, I don't know if it was a big issue in the first century, but he did say something about all sorts of things. And on another matter, he says, I give my opinion as one who by the Lord has been reckoned as faithful. Well, has the Lord reckoned you to be faithful? Or don't you have such a high opinion of yourself? Well, you'll never bring up kids if you don't have a high opinion of what God thinks of you. God has entrusted you with his children. I tell you what, he thinks you're some babysitter, doesn't he? And he's put you in charge of the gospel. He's allowed you to know his gospel. So can you see that the Lord comes to us not as those who marvellously got it together, but as humbled people, trust in God that he has taught us wisdom, and we're sure enough of that wisdom to be able to stuff it down the necks of our kids. Thank you very much. Do it, be reasonable. Do it my way. There's a place for that, isn't there? Certainly as the children are young. James also refers to the meekness of wisdom. It's not being smart, you see. James refers to the meekness of wisdom and says that the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason. There you are. But why? Well, if you haven't got 14 reasons, more fool you. Can you follow? Aren't there 14 reasons? I guess there is sometimes to say you wouldn't understand yet. I'm sure there are reasons sometimes, aren't there, where you can't explain the intricacies of psychology of violence or something or other as to why you've switched the cartoons off. Although even there, you can explain some things. I think it was Chris who actually explained. You did. Didn't you explain that matter to the children about the cartoons? Yes, we actually went to the children. We said, we've noticed that when you watch cartoons, your behaviour gets worse than when you don't watch cartoons. We gave them a reason, or Chris gave them a reason. She was very astute and noticed it. I don't mean to say all cartoons, but there are certain cartoons that just bred violence in them. So we said, no cartoons. And they were better behaved, and they realised they were better behaved, so there was a reason. Now, you're going to have to work that one out for your children, but can you see that there's the opportunity to explain certain things? It's open to reason, it's full of mercy and good fruits, but without uncertainty or insincerity. Now, it's interesting that that wisdom that he's talking about in James 3 arises out of the gospel. If you trace the book right through, you can see that he's talking about the wisdom that God gives, but it's the wisdom then that's practiced. So if you get up every morning and live in the covenant of God, can you see you're in the right environment, a learning environment, as we call it? And you'll learn lots of great things. Now, a person who's wise is a great delight to know. And don't we know it? It's just lovely to go to somebody who knows something, isn't it? And what we've got to hope is that our wisdom will appear so to our children. But finally, we've got to have it clear in our mind that the person who's got to approve our wisdom finally isn't our children. The person who's got to approve our wisdom is God. And we've got to know that we do what's right in his eyes and not just what's right in the eyes of our children. Now, it's quarter past. We've got just 10 minutes more, so we'll spend 5 minutes looking at this first thing, and then we'll have just an opportunity for a question or two and some comments before our cuppa at half past. Keeping the law, then. The Lord said to Israel, "This shall be your wisdom amongst the nations that I send you, that you keep my law." In other words, if Israel kept the law of God, they would be recognised as a very wise nation amongst the nations, and the nations would look at Israel and say, your law is a good law, look at it. And look at what it's done for you, because he said, for example, if they honoured their mother and father, they would live long in the land that the Lord their God gave them. So here was Israel, a nation that believed in parental discipline. Here was a nation that believed that it wasn't children that knew right, but parents that knew right. And other nations would look at what kind of a nation grew out of parents that trained the child up in the way they should go. Other nations would say, well, that builds a strong nation. It does good, doesn't it, if children are taught to honour their parents and honour their grandparents and honour their uncles and honour all men. That works a lot better than if we just thought about let them grow up anyhow, doesn't it? Can you see that wisdom will be apparent, even in the nations? Not all persons will confess it, but it will be there for them to see. So that was the way that God operated. It's the wise way to live. And particularly Psalm 1 says that, blessed is the man, happy, to be congratulated, is the man, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a man planted by streams of living water. See, I learned that as a child. Isn't it great to have been taught from a child and to have those things running through your head right from young? Isn't it great to be able to teach Psalm 1 to your children? And teach them that's the good way to live. Well, let's give an example. I've already illustrated really with honour your mother and father. What about the Sabbath? If your children see you as so frenetic and so anxious about your income and your business that you can't take a day off in a week and can't relax, can you appreciate that the children are learning big heaps by your breaking of the Sabbath law? I'm not a meticulous Sabbatarian, although I do prefer not to sort of do certain things on Sundays. But I think the law is not just a matter of whether you pull a few weeds from a garden on Sunday afternoon or whether you play tennis on a Sunday afternoon or something or other like that. The question is, are you so trusting in your God that you will keep His law, that there's some time when you have to relax, and there's some time when you have to take time right out, and you're not going to be a slave to your work. You see, that's one of the reasons for the Sabbath, because God stopped His work, and because He says, you're not slaves. Slaves work 7 days a week, but you're not slaves. I rescued you, God said, so you'll keep the Sabbath day, because you're not slaves. So you're a workaholic? Can you see you'd be breaking the fourth commandment, wouldn't you? And your children are learning that you don't really trust God, who's the creator of all things, to actually provide you with enough to eat out of 6 days' work? So you'd be teaching God that they had an unfaithful creator, wouldn't you, by not keeping His law? Of finding some way to fill out that command. We are to keep the whole law, right? I don't mean in a legalistic fashion, but on the other hand, the whole law is there. And somehow or another, we have to know that in Christ we're fulfilling that law. So, because that's the wise way to live. Other societies have tried to change the week to one day off in 10 and found it didn't work. God knew what was right. He knows that's the best way. It's the wise way to live. What about the command, you shall not commit adultery? And it's just very interesting, you see, that a girl came to me one day at Adelaide University. She came into the chaplain's office and said, I'd like to know if the church believes in sex before marriage, just like that. And I was the chaplain around at the time, so I thought, so we talked to her about that. And it put me on my mettle, because I realised that I didn't know enough about that as I ought to. I knew it was wrong, but I didn't know enough reason. So I said, well, can I look that up for you? I'd like to look it up for you. So I went through the scriptures. And it struck me that sex, as we call it, or copulation, is the marriage act. It has no part outside of marriage at all. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. It's very interesting, isn't it? Sex is the marriage act. It isn't an anything else act. And yet we use it in our society for just about everything else. We use it to sell. We use it to entertain. We use it to have jokes. Do you follow that? We've got a welter of that, and it's coming across on our televisions constantly. And somehow or another, we have to teach our children not just at the end that it's wrong to commit adultery, but we have to understand that all of the titillation that leads up to adultery is also wrong. And Jesus made that absolutely plain, didn't he? He said, I tell you, you say it's wrong to commit adultery. I tell you it's wrong to look at a woman lustfully. Can you see how right from young we need to be teaching our children that there are certain things that are part of the marriage act? And there are certain things that are very lovely within marriage, which are banal and commonplace and cheap if they're on television years and years and years before you can actually have the sex act, as we call it. Can you follow that it's no good trying to hold the horse in after it's bolted? We need to be, and the only way you can teach that to your children is in fact to live that way yourself. Because in fact, if you're cherishing all sorts of things in your head, of course you're going to tutor your children the wrong way. So do we hate adultery? Do we hate all that entices towards adultery? We really hate it? Well, I'm sure if we hate it, we'll be able to teach our children to do so without teaching them at the same time to be prudes. People who think one thing and do another will teach their children to be prudes, but people who really hate adultery will teach their children to hate adultery and hate all that leads up to it. Now, I'm not sure what that means in terms of your particular family, their particular age, but can you appreciate that somehow or another the law is the wise way to live, and if we love the law of God, if we're living in the law of God, we'll know it's the wise way to live, and we'll recognise the aberrations of it in all their forms and ways. Take another one, for example, covetousness. It's wrong to covet. That means that there's nothing of my neighbour's that I should really hanker after. Well, the opposite of covetousness is contentment, isn't it? So are we content with such things as we have? Or are we constantly griping about the fact that our car breaks down and we'd love to have a Mercedes? Our children pick up all those things. Can they see that we're happy with things that occasionally break down? Or are they learning that we are always ill at ease because we don't have what the Joneses have or something or other? All those things, you see, if we actually love the law ourselves, and then we'll be able to recognise the breakings of the law within ourselves, if we love the law, we'll be able to teach our children that which we already love ourselves.